Basic instructions before leaving Earth. This is Bible Radio, the internet radio ministry of Calvary Chapel, St. Paul in Minnesota. And this is Sunday Morning Live. Calvary Chapel, St. Paul is a non-denominational church dedicated to the teaching and living out of God's Word. And now, Sunday Morning Live.
Well, good morning to you. Good morning. Hey, we're going to be in a few different spots, so welcome to those who are listening via online. We have some friends from Israel listening in as well, in Sweden, a few other places. This week, on what's this next Wednesday coming up? The 29th, November 29th, I'm going to be interviewing somebody live from Israel, a believer I met there at the Jerusalem Church. Pretty cool saying that, Jerusalem Church there, believers. And so hopefully he's listening in and we'll just continue this conversation. And that'll go live 1 p.m. USA Central Time on the Chick-Chick Ellis Hour. So, and then the rebroadcast throughout the week. You guys been listening in, been enjoying the broadcast at all, hearing the stuff that's going on? All right, you're the one, huh, Esteban? All right, very good. All right, you're the same one who listens to Rick's show too, right? You're the one, all right, thank you. Well, we know he has two. Two listeners. Sweden says that makes it two. All right. Hey, let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for this morning. And I ask you to be Lord and lifted up as we come and approach a subject that the world seems to hate. Israel, whose land is it? And why should I care? So, Lord, we just give this morning to you. And I pray that we leave here today more on fire, more convicted, more committed, more submitted, more in love with you than when we came in this morning because of understanding your literal covenants and promises to this land and to this people. So we just praise you, we thank you, and just give you this time in Jesus' name. Amen. Hey, pay attention to the screens. For those of you listening online, pay attention to your speakers. But I have some audio here for you, and for you here that are, because you show up live, you get the video. So here, I want to give this to you right here.
Of all the countries that have come into existence in the last century, no country's birth certificate is more legitimate than that of Israel. One reason is that many of the men who founded the country, Theodore Herzl, Zeb Jabotinsky, David Ben-Gurion, Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, were either lawyers or had legal training. They were obsessed with making it legal. Unlike almost every other country, lawyers, not generals, were the midwives of Israel's birth, or more accurately, rebirth, since it had existed as an independent country twice before in history. Step by legal step, Israel moved legally toward nationhood, from the Balfour Declaration in 1917 to the San Remo Agreement in 1920 to the League of Nations Resolution in 1922 to the Anglo-American Convention on Palestine in 1924. To the partition of land ordained by the United Nations in 1947 into a nation state for the Jewish people and an Arab state. Yet immediately upon its lawful establishment in 1948 as the nation state of the Jewish people, Israel was illegally attacked by all the surrounding Arab states, as well as by elements of the local Arab population. In defending its right to exist during that war, Israel lost 1% of its population, including many civilians and Holocaust survivors. It also lost some of the land assigned to it by the United Nations. It captured other land from the aggressors that was originally assigned to the Arab state. The end result of that war against Israel was an armistice line that prevailed until 1967 when Israel was once again attacked by Jordan during Israel's war with Egypt and Syria. Between 1948 and 1967, despite the armistice, Arab terrorists continue to infiltrate Israeli borders and to injure and kill Israeli citizens. That was part of an official policy by the surrounding governments and by leaders of local Palestinian groups. All of it was in violation, obvious violation of international law. Following the establishment of Israel, a transfer of populations occurred. Several hundred thousand Arabs who fled from Israel during the War of Independence were not allowed to return. Some had chosen to leave, assured by their Arab leaders that the fledgling country would not last a week. Others were forced to leave. At that time, approximately the same number of Jews were forced to leave Arab countries, another violation of international law, where they had lived for thousands of years. The difference was that Arab countries kept the Arabs who left Israel in refugee camps, where many of them still live, more than a half a century after leaving Israel. And Israel, on the other hand, fully integrated all the Jewish refugees from Arab countries into Israeli society, where many of their descendants now serve in the highest positions of Israeli life. Israel's establishment as the nation state of the Jewish people by entirely lawful means is quite remarkable for several reasons. First, there is no country in the world that is as surrounded by hostile enemies as is Israel. It's been that way since 1948. Yet Israel sought the way of the pen rather than of the sword. It has needed the sword to survive, but its preference has always been for the pen. That is, for peaceful negotiations. Its peace treaty with Egypt in 1978, its peaceful abandonment of Gaza in 2005, and its many attempts to reach a peace agreement with the Palestinians are examples. Yet despite its entirely lawful origins, Israel is the only country in the world today whose origins, and therefore its very legitimacy, have been questioned by the General Assembly of the United Nations, by numerous member nations, and by many organizations that claim the mantle of human rights and the rule of law. Ironically, current attacks on Israel's legitimacy have taken the form of lawfare, the use of international law as a weapon. Any fair tribunal that judged Israel by universal standards would reject such attacks out of hand. But alas, international courts like the UN itself have been packed by those bitterly antagonistic to the nation state of the Jewish people. For example, the misnamed International Court of Justice refuses to acknowledge that Israel, a country that deals with terror attacks and the threats of terror attacks on a regular basis, has any special security needs. As I've demonstrated, this phenomenon, questioning the very right of Israel to exist as the nation state of the Jewish people, cannot be explained on legal grounds or on any other rational basis for that matter. So then, how can this worldwide attack on Israel alone be explained? In only one way. It is pure bigotry. And there's a word for this bigotry: anti-Semitism. If you have a better explanation for why the one country in the world whose right to exist is denied is also the one country that is the nation state of the Jewish people, I ask you, what is it?
Well, Alan Dershowitz, I do have a better explanation. And it's a big one. He is not a believer. You can go to Prager University. These are non-believers. The majority of them were defending Israel as well, and as many some believers as you can go to Prager University. But I do have a biblical explanation of why. Hey, congratulations to those of you who are listening online that you've stuck this far, and congratulations to some of you or all of you. I didn't see anyone get up and leave out as soon as Israel was mentioned. When I was researching this, and as I always do, I go to Rabbi Google. I do a search engine for it, and I was really blown away this time studying on this subject on the anti-Semitism, the bigotry, the anti-Semitism. Just the name of Israel alone irks angst in people. And that's the thing, as I was growing up as a non-believer, as a pagan, as a Christian Scientist, believing I was my own God, why was there such this hatred for Israel? Why were they the blame for just everything throughout Europe? Why did Hitler blame them for things? Why did Mussolini? Why did Genghis Khan? Why did all Alexander the Great, being a Greek boy, that's my hometown there, Greek, why do they hate the Jews? Why is it this people group, the most persecuted people group in all of the world's history, enslaved more, conquered more, damaged more? Why does China have the same amount of 6,000 years of history, and there is a billion Chinese? And Israel has the same 6,000 years of world history, and there's only 12 million Jews, 6 million of them alone, just living in Israel alone. Why is that? Because they have been the most persecuted people group of all of the world's history. And so, as Alan Dershowitz said, if you have a better explanation, well, I can tell you that clear and simply, because they abandoned God. That's the short answer. God was disciplining, punishing them, dealing with them because they had abandoned God. Remember, there was no such thing as Jewish people. There was no such thing as Israel, as Israelites. God took a heathen worshiping pagan named Abram, and he says, now you're going to be Abraham. And he took his wife Sarai and named her Sarah, and you're going to be a race of people, and you're going to have a promised child. Remember that promise. She was 90, he was 100. She laughed. Therefore, they named their son Isaac Laughter. That's a continual reminder. And so we go all the way back to this land of the Bible. For those of you listening online, you're going to have to open up your Bibles in the back there and look at some of the maps that I'm showing you here. But Genesis chapter 12 through 15 tells us. Now, if you look at this red line right here, that goes all the way to the Euphrates River. And if you look at all the landmarks right there, that is the promised land of Genesis chapter 12 through 15. That's a lot of land. That's a lot of land from the Mediterranean, that great sea, to the Euphrates River. It encompassed what is modern day Syria, Iraq, Jordan, and Egypt and those parts. That is the promised land. But because of Israel's abandonment of God, they only possibly at best comprised and took the possession of maybe a tenth of the promised land. If you've been with us for any other study, you know that that's also sometimes what happens in a Christian's walk as well. God has promised you all these things, but as Christians, we tend to only appropriate that which makes us the most comfortable instead of after going after the rest. And right now, modern-day Israel only comprises about an eighth of the promised land that God said that you should have in Genesis chapter 12 through 15. The long and the short of it is that they abandon God because God says, I'm going to take you and make you a race and a nation of people, and you are going to be my children. And the world's going to see how my children are treated by their God, their father, and the world's going to want to get in on that. You were to be a light to the world. And again, we see when Jesus cleanses the temple a couple of times. You made him a den of robbers, but you've also made my house, my father's house, a house of prayer, that of thieves. And so, again, going back to that whole promised land and the literal covenant. So, whose land is it? And why should I care? Genesis chapter 12, now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said to your descendants, I will give this land and these, and there we build an altar to the Lord. And he appeared to him. We see this going back to Genesis chapter 13. For all the land which you see, I give you and your descendants for how long? Forever. Whose land is it and why should I care? Listen, Christian, if you're not already upset just because I've mentioned Israel and Jews, ask yourself, why is that causing you problems? Why do you think of just when he mentioned Jews or Israel, do people just get upset? Why is Israel in the news every day? Every day, this tiny little country, the only democratic country, surrounded by all Muslim countries. And again, all the lands that we're going to see that Israel possessed legally has either purchased those or won those in conquest when they were, again, attacked. We know the land of Israel. And so again, all the land that you see, again, that promise given to him. You begin with the Canaanite conquest in 1400 B.C. and ended in 606 B.C. Essentially, no autonomous rule since May 14, 1948. That alone, listen, no other people group has ever been destroyed and assimilated in another country and has ever regathered and come back together as a nation. Only one nation in all of the world's history is Israel. May 14th, 1948. They existed again. They kept their national identity. They kept their language. They kept all their traditions. No other conquered people. The ancient Chaldeans at best maybe lasted 300 years after being conquered. We look at the Ottoman Turk Empire from 1553 to 1922. That's through the end of World War I. We look at, again, there's always been a Jewish presence in Israel. Mark Twain, always liked quoting him. Basically, he went there and visited and said, there's just really nothing left. This is a desolate, desolate place. Now, I was not able to take people with me to the Rockefeller Museum this time. But there they have pictures from the time that Mark Twain was there. And to see what Jerusalem, Hebron, and Bethlehem, and all the cities that we've been to looked like during Mark Twain's time, that's like the 1900s, folks. That's two centuries ago. To understand what it looked like, to see those pictures and to see what it is like. And that's what he looked at. He says, what's the big deal about this? What's the big deal about this place of all the places to be at? We look at Chaim Weizmann and the first king that we've seen of Iraq. A good story, or a good movie for you to watch is Lawrence of Arabia. It's 3 hours. It's Lawrence of Arabia. And that shows you how these Bedouins and these nomads were actually put in and had kings and the kingdoms that they had. It was basically through World War I and the British government trying to assimilate or trying to get all the nomads and the Bedouins together to try to help them fight, Jim, to try to help them fight the back screen here, to try to help them fight the Turks. And they're the ones who gave them monarchy, that gave them kings. And so this is the first king of Iraq. It's okay now. We see here that the king of Saudi Arabia, again, talking to them, there was no king. He was a king by his own rights and his own mind at that time. But talking to the British government, why are you so obsessed? Folks, you can look at the screen and read their quotes. But why are you so obsessed? Why do they rule you? They're not going to exist. And that was the plan. After World War I, we're just going to wipe out the Jews. Now that we're all together, we're going to finish and wipe out what we have already set in place here. Again, you could look at the whole Ottoman Turk Empire. You can look at what is Palestine at that time, what they called Palestine. They wouldn't even call it Israel. It wasn't even going by that name. But every other Jew knew what it was, called it Israel. And so you can see that this was the mandate. They said, okay, after World War I, we're going to give them a lamb. There's always been a continuous presence of Jewish people in Israel. This whole thing about that they've never existed, it wasn't until May 14th, 1948, they came in and they invaded. There's always been. We see that all the way back to 606 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar didn't take everyone out of. He killed a lot of people, and he left a lot of people still in Israel. Nehemiah, as we're going to study the first of the year, as we go through the book of Nehemiah, when he came back, there was Jews there. There was people of the land of the Bible still there, so it wasn't this desolate. In 1922, Winston Churchill, again, we have that the Churchill's white paper saying, hey, let's give them this land. It's theirs. It should be theirs. They could understand. Theodore Herzl, who put together the first Zionist Congress, never visited Israel. He was there in Europe and petitioned the access powers there to give us a land. That's why he's highly honored and favored in there. You can look at this UN partition in 1947. You can look at this. You can look at the Jewish. Look, this is what Israel comprises. This is what the UN said. Look, we're going to give you all this. They did not have. They kept Jerusalem as an international zone. But that was that was in 1947. And then you can see on the various maps there as we go through. Listen to Harry S. Truman, the first country to recognize Israel. And he says the question of Palestine as a Jewish homeland goes back to the solemn promise that had been made to them, the Jews, by the British and Balfour Declaration of 1917, as World War I was coming to its climax, saying, look, after World War I, we're going to give you guys a homeland. By the way, which comprised what is now called Jordan, but they said Transjordan. So the east and west bank of the Jordan River was going to be part of the new Palestine. So all the way back in 1917, he says, a promise which had stirred the hopes and the dreams of these oppressed peoples, this promise, I felt should be kept, just as all promises made by responsible civilized governments should be kept. Harry S. Truman, after World War II. And so again, they recognized him. It was Chaim Weizmann who came to him. They would have been called anything, New Palestine, whatever. Harry S. Truman, the president at that time, says, look, we'll recognize you as long as you call yourself Israel. He said, call us whatever you want. Call us Israel, call us whatever you find. They were Zionists. They were not Orthodox. They were not religious. They were considered themselves Zionists. We just need a country of our own so we can be safe and secure, because they were just coming out of what we still call the Holocaust to this day. So they said, okay, we'll call ourselves Israel. When you go to Israel and you look at their history of what they had gone through, they were going to be the Kingdom of David. They had all different types of flags that they had designed and things, what they were going to call. But they said Israel, because Harry S. Truman says, well, I read my Bible. The Bible calls you Israel. That's what we're going to recognize you as Israel. Their war for independence, that again started in May 14th, 1948. May 15th, they were attacked by all these other nations surrounding them. And they told all the people, all the Arabs, get out. We're going to drive them into the sea. That which Hitler started, we are going to finish. The UN green line was this. So there's green around that blue. That's what Israel was. If none of the nations would have attacked, that's what the nation of Israel would look like. But the other nations attacked, and Israel says, well, okay, we're going to defend ourselves. 726,000 Arab refugees, exiles during the war, equal number of Jews forced out of Arab countries. They just emptied all the countries, Jews. If you guys don't realize, even up until this last war with Iraq, there still was a synagogue in Baghdad. There's Jews who are still living in, well, not anymore, let alone the Christians are being killed and slaughtered. But under Saddam Hussein, there was still people who never left and said, I'm an Iraqi. Iraq's my home. I just happen to be Jewish. And so again, we see that the same number, they put them in. They said, look, all you Arabs out, it'll just be a weekend, week at best. Put all the Jews, they exported them, expelled them all there so they could totally wipe them out. It just didn't happen. The Egyptian campaign, again, Nasser, the president of Egypt at the time, buying lots of weapons. They're going to, again, that war of independence really didn't work out for them. They got more land. East and West Jerusalem was separated. And so Israel, this is what's going to come to the Six-Day War. Yasser Arafat, interesting, not Palestinian. He's the one who came up with the word Palestinian. He's an Egyptian. This is, again, Pastor Chick talking to you, and I'm just going to lower it down for you. He was a thug who could not make it in Egypt, and he found an oppressed people group, and he wanted to be popular, so he went to the eastern bank of the Jordan River, May 14th. So in 1948, all the Arab nations said, get out of Israel, and they put them on the eastern bank of the Jordan River, which is now called Jordan. Hang out there. They built camps, tents. They knew an attack was coming because all these refugee cities or these camps were set up. 750,000. Says, once we kill all the Jews, come back. You not only get your house, but take any home from any Jew there as well. It just didn't work out. And it wasn't that Israel said that you can't come back into the land. Israel says, if you come back into the land, you're going to be an Israeli citizen. You'll have an Israeli passport. You'll serve in the military, whether you be Muslim or not. The Arab nations around them said, no, and began the war of propaganda. And they were being oppressed. For 9 years being oppressed, Yasser Arafat leaves Egypt. He was a thug who could not make it in Egypt. And so now he's going to go. The original intent of Yasser Arafat, which, by the way, was not the PLO. Nasser, the president at that time, came up with a counter thing to counter Yasser Arafat. And he called it the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. You're like, wait a minute. I see the look in some. Yasser Arafat's always been known as part of the PLO. Folks, it's all the war of propaganda. Yasser Arafat went to go find an oppressed people group so he could be somebody, and he was doing it. That's why King Abdullah, who's the king now of Jordan, his dad killed 150,000 Palestinians in a slaughter because they were an uprising. Right now, 60% of the population of Jordan consider themselves Palestinian. Jordanians are part of the Hashemite kingdom. Go back and watch Lawrence of Arabia, and you'll get the whole thing about the kingdoms and the various tribes. He is a Hashemite. And so, again, his daddy had to kill 150,000 of them in just a matter of a week or two to quell an uprising. So Nasser, the president of Egypt, started the PLO to counteract Yasser Arafat. It wasn't until 1964 that Yasser Arafat kind of took over everything and started calling Arabs Palestinians. There is no Palestinian history. There is no Palestinian prophet. There's nothing to distinguish them from Islam. Islam did not show up on the scene until the 7th century A.D. That's after the death of Christ, or A.C.E., after Common Era, as the museums put it now. 1964. So asking this question, why do people get so upset when it comes to Israel? May 16th, 1967, Radio Cairo. The existence of Israel has continued long enough. We welcome the Israeli aggression. Well, wait a minute. Egypt's the one buying up all the Soviet-made weapons and planes and armaments. All the other six nations around Israel are the ones who are coming up on their border. Who went with us to Israel? Sasha, did you see a fence from any one of the other countries? You only saw Israel's fence and border up, didn't you? There was no man. There was no, that's the thing I kept pointing out. Where's the other country's fence? There's no other country afraid of Israel invading them or doing anything. They have to protect themselves. It says, we're going to take care of this aggression and we're going to wipe them all out. King Hussein of Jordan, that's King Abdullah's dad, the armies of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon are poised on the borders of Israel to face the challenge. While standing behind us are the armies of Iraq, Algeria, Kuwait, Sudan, and the whole Arab nation. This act will astound the world. Oh, it did. That's called the Six-Day War. That didn't do well for them. This act will astound the world. Today they will know that the Arabs are arranged for battle. The critical hour has arrived. We have reached the stage of serious action, not declarations. It's not a red line. It's just they're going to do something here. And so here we have Iraqi president, same thing, May 31st. This is our opportunity to wipe out, taking care of all the Jews. It's been a plight on us since 1948. These are all the nations around them saying this is what's going to happen. And so this is, if you look at the blue there, this is what comprised of Israel before the Six-Day War. Then territories occupied in 1970. Hello? You see, every time, this is why Muslim countries hate declaring a jihad against Israel, because they lose more real estate. Their theology is, or their thing of God is, if they declare a jihad, they're supposed to win, and they give up more and more real estate. Israel took over the Sinai Peninsula. In fact, the president of Egypt, Nasser, for weeks would not admit that 10 battalions of Egyptian soldiers were captured in the Sinai. And it was Israel who was feeding them and clothing them and watering them. He left them all to die, all to die. Doesn't want to acknowledge that they were even existed there. Now, in 1979, we're going to see that President Jimmy Carter at the time worked out some type of peace deal and made them give back the Sinai. It had already been developed. There had already been kibbutzes there. Israelis were going there and vacationing because they had the whole Sinai Peninsula. But he also gave away the Panama Canal too, so what should we expect? All right, thus I digress. October 6, 1973 is the three-day war, Yom Kippur, and the holiest day of all the nations decide to attack. 2,700 Israeli soldiers and 8,500 Arab soldiers died in 1 month of heavy fighting during the Yom Kippur. It was basically 3 days, but there were still skirmishes going on for the next month. Anwar Sadat, Jimmy Carter, and Menachem Begin in 1979, 1980, actually making that peace deal. And what happened in July of 1981? Anwar Sadat was assassinated at one of his own parades by that peace-loving organization known as the Islamic Brotherhood. And as that parade was going on, I'm in the Marines. We thought we were going to be going into the Middle East then. And he was assassinated at his own parade there for making a peace deal with Israel. So whose land is it and why should I care? PLO became the Palestinian National Authority with Arafat as its president. The PLO was to counteract Yasser Arafat, was to combat him, this little thug who couldn't make it in Egypt with thuggery, and yet now he is known as the leader of the PLO. Peace treaty signed with Jordan in 1994. Interesting thing there. They had a peace treaty in 67. When Israel had already crossed over the Dead Sea, the Jordan River, and they were just 25 miles away from Amman, King Hussein says, "Hey, we're ready to make a peace with you, a ceasefire." We cease fire. In 1994, they signed a peace treaty. There was an incident on the border. A Jordanian soldier massacred about, I think, 16 school children. On this last tour, I took people to Old Geshur there. That's that incident that had happened. King Hussein came over to Egypt. He sat on the floors. That's a type of mourning with all the parents of these slaughtered school children who were there on a field trip. This Jordanian soldier from the Jordanian side opened up fire, killed them all. And he sat and he mourned with them. And Jordan and Israel kind of became friends. And he said, we're going to go from a ceasefire to having a peace treaty. So that, by the way, is biblical. you're going to see, because Petra is in the land of modern-day Jordan right now, and it's where the tribulation saints are going to run to, where we also have hid some Bibles in those caves. The Camp David talks, also in 2000, known as the Oslo Agreements, a la President Clinton. Israel agreed to give up. This is with a prime minister who lost his prime ministership because of this deal. He wanted to prove, he put his whole prime, Ehud Barak, he put his whole presidency or his prime ministership on the line. He says, look, and he did it as an example, they do not want peace with us. Was going to give them 91% of everything that they wanted. September 2000, Sharon, so they didn't want it. Yasser Arafat turned it down because of one thing. All Ehud Barak said it wanted is, you need to remove from the Hamas, Hezbollah, the PLO charter, that Israel's right to exist, is they, you need to acknowledge them as a legitimate country and a state. Because it's in their constitution or their charter that they will not recognize Israel. They will not say the name of Israel. They will not do that. Just do that one thing and we'll give you it. And Yasser Arafat said no, turned it all down, and it astounded the world. In 2000, Sharon, the prime minister at the time, visited the Temple Mount. And if you remember that, that's where that whole rock-throwing incident happened, and they were killing people. And then the propaganda, there's a thing called in Bethlehem called Pallywood, Palestinian manufactured news. And if you go back, some of you weren't even born then, in 2000, there was this child that was being cradled by his father. Go back and do a search into this. And it says that he was shot by Israeli soldier snipers. The problem is that there are no rocks up on the Temple Mount area. It's a very pristine area. We weren't able to get up on the Temple Mount at this time. And that wall is some 150 yards away from the actual retaining wall, which is known as the Western Wall, formerly known as the Wailing Wall. That would have been a miraculous bullet. We've seen one of those happen in November 1963, right? This miraculous bullet comes over the temple, ricochets off the Dome of the Rock and comes back another 150 yards and shoots this kid. Oh, by the way, the kid, the 8-year-old kid who died, yeah, they found him in France alive and they videoed him and they interviewed him. Doesn't seem to be dead. This whole thing propaganda. But that started what's known as the Infantada. This was Sharon's 8th scheduled visit of 12 that year. It wasn't a surprise. News media proposed that Sharon goes up and rushes the Temple Mount area. For those of you who've been with us, Israel, can you really rush up that plank and get into that Temple Mount area that the line goes out about a mile? That's why we didn't visit it this time. We're not going to waste a whole day standing in line. And so it was his 8th scheduled visit. It wasn't a surprise. It was all about propaganda. Began that second Infantada there. So what are some other things? The Saudi Arabian ambassador, Prince Bandar, the Alban Sultan, if Arafat does not accept what is available now, it won't be a tragedy, it will be a crime. Everyone's saying, Arafat, take the deal, take the deal. And he says, no, we're not going to acknowledge Israel's right to existence. Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it just as it obliterated others before it. Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam obliterates it. That's the Hamas charter. That's what Yasser Arafat was all about. That's what's happening even today in Israel. The Jews are a cancer which is liable to spread again at any moment. Look at 1997 here. There is no solution to the conflict except the disappearance of Israel, the head of the Hezbollah. If they all gather in Israel, it will save us the trouble of going after them worldwide. This is it. Whose land is it? What's going on here? O Allah, 1997. O Allah, destroy America as it's controlled by Zionist Jews. Allah will avenge in the name of his prophet the colonist settlers who are the descendants of monkeys and pigs. We see that from the coming from the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is on the Temple Mount area, which is to the south of the Dome of the Rock. The Dome of the Rock is a rock. They believe that Muhammad stepped his foot on, then a winged Pegasus took him up to heaven, and that's where he received the Quran. He came back to that place, that rock right there, got off it, and then was whisked back to Mecca, all in one night thing, okay? I'm not going to question their belief system there, but it seems highly improbable. But this is from that same Temple Mount Air, from the mosque. For those of you who are listening to the Chick Chakelis Hour this last week, that we were in Jerusalem and we had to pause where we were at the Garden Tomb because one of the five times of Muslim prayer was going off. Those are the things that are chanted from that tower. These things, we hear Allah Akbar, and then a whole bunch of other little things there. I keep asking for the Aloha snack bar because I get hungry every time I hear about it, but you can't point me to that. This is what's chanted from it. That's what they hear across Israel. Palestine, 1911 war ended as a catastrophe that is unnecessary in history when the Zionist gangs stole Palestine. There's always been a Jewish presence in Israel. Islam didn't exist until the 7th century. Descendants, listen, in the Oslo Agreement of 2000, that President Bill Clinton at the time brokered this deal, Israel was to no longer be antagonist towards any Palestinians, and Palestine or Palestinians were supposed to be teaching in their schools coexistence with Israel, that they're their friend. Israel did it. Palestine never did it. This is in their textbooks. Leading up to something here, folks. This is in their textbooks. They describe terrorism as resistance acts of most glorious heroism. Well, here, Kimberly and I, after the Israel tour, we spent a week in New York, and we're just strolling the streets, and we're just coming up to this memorial plaza. This is where Tower 1 stood at the World Trade Towers. This is where Tower 2 stood at the World Trade Towers. This is what's now called the Freedom Tower, courtesy of a peaceful religion of Islam. For those of you who were with us in Israel, during 9/11, we had crossed over on September 10th from Jordan after seeing Petra and being there a few days and coming into Israel. We're actually watching CNN at that time. We had to turn it to a different Spanish channel to get better news coverage. But the CNN reporter at that time, when the second tower was coming down and collapsing, said, who was there? Do you remember that? What does Israel expect being friends with Israel? They brought this on themselves. That's what we heard while in Israel. These are the things. So whose land is it? Well, Alan Dershowitz, I got something for you. Ezekiel 11:17 says, therefore says, thus saith the Lord God, I will gather you from the peoples, assemble you from the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. Let's just take America right now and look at Israel. Israel right now is comprised of Jews from 120 countries. Now, there's Russian, there's all these other languages there, but Russia puts up its own fence. Russia has its own immigration policy and deports people. Israel says you have 2 years to learn the language if you even want to have a possible chance of being an Israeli citizen or you just have a residence card. But 120 countries are represented. How's that in America when you can go and take a driver's test in 120 languages, but all the street signs are in English? So every nation in the world has an immigration policy and has a thing that you will assimilate. We went and had a goodbye dinner in a city called Abu Ghosh. It's an Arab village. They sided with Israel. Now, this village is an amazing village because none of the Arabs left. And the mayor of Abu Ghosh said, we're going to stand with Israel. And this is during the War of Independence, May 14, 19. No other country in the world thought that they were going to exist. And the Arabs said, we've always coexisted with our, we've never had an issue with Jews, with Israelis. We consider ourselves Israeli, Palestinian, whatever you want to call ourselves. And Abu Ghosh, the mayor says, we're going. And as the mayor of this city, if you don't want, you get out and you can go to the other country, but you ain't coming back. And so now on Sabbath, Jews travel over the hill from Jerusalem down to Abu Ghosh because that's the only place they can get a falafel because everything else is closed. And then on Sunday, because the majority of these Arabs are Christians, when their Sabbath is going on, they got to leave Abu Ghosh and go into Jerusalem and get their falafel. It's just that way. Some of us, you discovered that on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there's usually one third of the taxi force is out of commission, and the taxi rates rise because on Friday sundown to Saturday sundown, the Jews are off. Then you have the Muslims from Saturday on, and then you have the Christian Arabs, which means Catholic, by the way. They're off on Sunday. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, one-third of the taxis are out, so the prices go up. But Monday, they all go back down. Abu Ghosh cited, and so did many of the Druze. If you weren't watching the news, we were there. There's a city, a Druze village, that's inside the border of Syria. But the Druze have always sided with Israel. It's a different culture. It's a little bit of Islam, but they got their own religions. I'm not even going to try to explain it. But here's the thing. Hold up, Ed. And so here's the thing that it comes down to is that they've always cited. Israel says, if anything happens, we're going to defend that Druze village. Even though you're in Syria, you're under our benefactory. We were right there on the Syrian-Israeli border. We could hear, we could hear bombs bursting in the air and their whole independence. We can hear things going on there. And it's not a civil war. It's a genocide what Muslims are doing to each other Muslims. But no one. ISIS? IS, they get involved, they'll be was. And no one comes around. No one wants Israel. So now this protected little village, everyone stays far away from it. We see here in the land of Israel that really when it comes down to it, I got this other video here for you. Klavan on the culture, he has a solution. He has a solution because they're trying to divide Israel up. Well, he's got a solution here.
That's why today, we here at Klavan on the Culture would like to lay out what we consider the only plan likely to bring tranquility, freedom, and justice to the region. The one-state solution in which the entire Middle East is given to the Jews. That's right. The one-state solution is a proposal of genius that would not only help the Palestinians, but would instantly achieve the noblest goals of the so-called Arab Spring. For instance, turning the entire Middle East into one big Israel will secure religious freedom for everyone in the area. As things stand, Muslim states either ban other religions completely or torment their practitioners to the point of extinction. Not so Israel. Although Jimmy Carter and other leftists pretending not to be anti-Semites have accused Israel of practicing religious apartheid, the fact is Muslims and Christians have full freedom of religion in the Jewish state. They can and do vote and serve in the Israeli parliament and Supreme Court. They can and do volunteer to serve in the Israeli defense forces. And only under the Jews are the religious sites of the Holy Land open to all. Indeed, once the entire Middle East becomes Israel, most of the region's Arabs will be freer and better off in every way than they've ever been before. The United Nations reports that Israel is far more democratic and more advanced in human development than any Arab state. And of course, only in Israel is that half of the population, sometimes known as women, or sweetheart, or baby, given full human rights. Handing control of the Middle East over to the Jews is such a terrific idea. In fact, many of you may be thinking, hey, maybe the Jews should run America too. Of course, some anti-Semites believe the Jews already run America, but that's ridiculous. If the Jews ran America, we wouldn't be $14 trillion in debt. Knuckleheads. For more information on Israel, try searching the subject on Front Page Magazine at frontpagemag.com. This is Andrew Klavan on The Culture.
When doing this research and seeing all the people, the anti-Semitism that's going on, here's the land of Israel. This is looking down to the Dead Sea. This is from En Gedi. Some other shots here. Beautiful land here. So why should I care? Why should I care? Whose land is it? Listen, all the quote-unquote occupied territories, the Hula Valley, everything, all those were legally purchased. Only the Golan Heights that was taken in the Six-Day War, again, was that brought back in. And also with Israel during the Yom Kippur, or in 67, Jerusalem was reunited. And in 73, in the Yom Kippur War, did they get back the Golan Heights. But here's what comes in the question. So congratulations to those of you who are still sitting here. For those who are listening online, here's another thing that I would give you. Again, this is from Prager University. Do you pass the Israel test?
How do you respond to people who excel you in invention, creativity, and wealth? Do you envy them? Do you feel their success somehow diminishes you? Or do you admire what they've achieved and try to emulate it? These questions sum up what I call the Israel test. In the 1880s, European Jews settled in Mandate, Palestine, and wrought an agricultural miracle in that desolate territory. Then sparsely populated by a few score thousand Jews and a couple hundred thousand Arabs, the Jewish settlers drained malarial swamps, leached salt from the soils, terraced the barren hills, and planted millions of trees. They massively expanded the capacity of the land and enabled it to support a substantial Arab population. In the two decades between 1921 and 1943, Jews quadrupled the number of enterprises, multiplied the number of jobs by a factor of 10, and increased the level of capital investment 100-fold. Far from displacing Arabs, they provided the capital for a major expansion of Arab farms and enabled a 7-fold rise in Arab population by 1948. To a level of 1.35 million, the largest in the long history of Palestine. In other words, the Arabs came to what would soon be the state of Israel because of the Jews. By comparison, Transjordan, now known as Jordan, with the same geological endowment and four times the land, but no Jews, was able to sustain a population density only one-tenth of the population density of Palestine. Crucial to Israel's accomplishments were world-leading technological advances in the recovery of water through desalinization, drip irrigation, and sewage recycling. Over the past 50 years, Israel has increased its population tenfold, its agricultural production 16-fold, and its industrial production 50-fold, while actually reducing net water consumption by 10% since 1948. This huge expansion of effective water resources enabled the land to support not only more Jews, but also millions more Arabs. Today, the state of Israel, with its astonishing achievements in computer science and other high-tech fields, distills both the genius of the Jews and the misdirected anger of the failed states that surround her. The great divide in the Middle East is not between Arab and Jew, but between admiration of achievement, along with the desire to replicate it, and envy accompanied by violent resentment. People who admire success, who pass the Israel test, tend to be wealthy and peaceful. People who resent achievement, who fail the Israel test, tend to become poor and violent. So again, how do you respond to people who excel you in invention, creativity, and wealth? Do you envy them? Do you feel their success somehow diminishes you? Or do you admire what they've achieved and try to emulate it? The Israel test is the central divide in the world today. How you answer it as an individual, and ultimately how we answer it as a nation, is a test of our own will to triumph over enemies who hate us, as they hate Israel, for what is best within us.
So why should I care? Again, that's just on the fleshly human level. We know that there's a spiritual component to this, that, again, the world will hate Israel. I'm going to do a part two next week for this, because after I get into this interview I'm going to do on Wednesday. But I want to show you some things here. The temple does not exist on the Temple Mount, but there will be a third temple. Could this be what it looks like? I don't know, but I'm going to get into part two. Here's some of the pictures of the very stones that the Romans had pushed off to the side and destroyed the temple. I see that I really just need to get into doing part two. I was going to really do this for my friend Adam right here. This is a bomb, Adam. This is a bomb and how to defuse a bomb, but I'm going to have to get into that to next week. But I want to finish up with this. when it comes into the church and why I should care. This is Shiloh. And again, I've asked for some people on this last tour to give me why they wanted to, or just give me one picture of why you care about Israel. This is the original meeting place of God, Shiloh. For 369 years, the tabernacle was there. We have Sherry, who got baptized along with her very own Teo right here, explaining of why she got baptized and how, again, as we baptized, they said, well, we hope this one takes. Sherry is sharing from those things. You have Steve Ripley, Annette's husband, who's just blown away. This is the Mektesh. This is the crater at Mitzpah Rimon. And just of him just thinking, you can read the titles right there. It's a benefit for people online of just how they crossed the promised land and how they came into Israel. And we're doing it on a bus. And it's still hard. Here's Zoe Wetter talking about worshiping at the original meeting place of God in the promised land. All that land and all those maps that I was showing you there. Tanya Wetter showing a picture of En Gedi, of a waterfall, and what that meant to her. And of just being in Israel. And Mary Beth taking a picture of Cassie doing worship. You'd have to see all the garbage and trash that was below Cassie there. But we're overlooking the Sea of Galilee on a roadside pull-up stop, and because we're doing worship every day. It blew our driver and our guide away. And you can see Taya and why she wanted to get baptized. Taya, I hope this one sticks as well. This is good. But getting baptized there in the Jordan River. Josiah, his accomplishment was that he made it to the top of En Gedi and was able to look down. Pastor Seth, of just of us there overlooking Mitzpah Rimon, and why I should care, because we're in the actual land that these things are happening, that we read in our Bible, that we're making a connection to. That's why I can't encourage you enough to go with us in 2019 on the next one. Yes, there'll be another tour. But this is the making that connection and just how everything just comes up. And then again, Thomas just saying, hey, of just being able to worship every day, being able to just to worship, being our guide and our driver, our new guide and new driver. It was hard for them. And just like, why do you want to, well, let's go here and let's go and do this. And she kept saying, well, usually I said, you got to knock that word out of your vocabulary, man. Don't use that with us. And I was like, because we want to start off the day worshiping and land. That's what's most important to us. And we can see those things. Going to the Israeli National Museum and seeing the bone box, seeing artifacts from the time of Caiaphas during Jesus' time, that these people, these figures, these aren't fairy tables, these aren't fables. These are the things that really exist. And again, if you listen to our radio interview there on top of the Golan Heights, now again, we can take a bus down to the Damascus Road and see where Paul was converted and stuff like that. Or we can take dune buggies, Hot Wheels! It's the same amount of money. It all works out, and we're there, and we can get a briefing of really what's going on. Or how about Annette taking a picture there of coming to the high place there in Petra, going over to Petra. Now, I like this one. This one came in this morning. I checked my email today, and I really like this one. That's a Cafe Fouque, a cappuccino and a Magnum. But it's a little bit more than that. Where he leads me, I will follow. What he feeds me, I will swallow. These words rang in my head as the plane lifted off. I was leaving my family, my country, my comfort zone, and everything else behind for no better reason than because God told me to. God never said following him would be easy, but he never said that we would have to do it alone either. He never promised comfort, but he did promise a comforter. In Israel, I tried foods I normally wouldn't have tried. Yeah, that's true. Talked with people I wouldn't normally talk with, and walked and walked and walked. I got tired, but through it all, I was never alone. God was with us on that trip. I could feel it, and he was with us. Now too, but I will never forget that feeling of that closeness with him on the Israel trip. Very own Paul. Where he leads me, I will follow. What he feeds me, I will swallow. And then for our very own guide, we went to the original Holocaust Museum Memorial now, and on that was a plaque from her father's village She was blown away. We took her to so many places she's never been, and she didn't want to go in there, but she's a guide. She has to come with us, and she stayed away from the crowd. She went out to the courtyard, saw all these grave markers, and they represent all the villages where Jews were slaughtered throughout the Holocaust. And this was from her father's town. In fact, the rabbi who's mentioned on there wrote a song that she sang as a child, and the title of it's right there on that plaque. You see, for me, as I'll end with this, is praying and worshiping with believers in the Jerusalem church. And that's just how I would like to leave you this morning, being able to worship with the Jewish believers there, Messianic, people from 120 different countries, Jews comprising the world coming together who've accepted Yeshua as their Messiah. And here we are worshiping together in Jerusalem, where the Bible was actually lived out and where it happened. So God bless you folks. Pray God fills you and blesses you today as we just finish out the rest of this service, that you can join with us in what we experienced there in Jerusalem.
This is Bible Radio.